Welcome to the Australian Chiropractors Association podcast. The ACA is the peak body representing chiropractors in Australia. These podcasts explore the science, art, philosophy, and politics of chiropractic, as well as reviewing the latest research and discussing how chiropractors can strive for excellence in practice.
Welcome to the Australian Chiropractors Association podcast. I'm your podcast host, Kim Lejeune. I'm actually really excited about today's podcast, guys. So I've got a very special guest. I've known Brent for a little while now as a chiropractor and as a friend. He's a very esteemed chiropractor. I'll run through his bio and you'll understand what I'm talking about, but I can't wait to dive into today's discussion and all things that is neuro and neurovascular, really. But I want to, before we do that, I want to really have a chat about Brent's bio. It's quite extensive, so bear with me as I run through this, and I want to talk about some of our stuff that he's done in the past as well. Brent is a registered chiropractor and osteopath who completed a Bachelor of Medical Science with honors at the University of Sydney back in 1995, achieving the highest mark in his year, and a Master's of Chiropractic at Macquarie University in 1997. Brent is one of the small number of Australians who hold the qualifications of a diplomat of the American Chiropractic Neurology Board. Following extensive training and examinations in chiropractic functional neurology and chiropractic neurorehabilitation by the Carrick Institute, Brent is a clinical fellow and a past board member of the Australasian Academy of Functional Neurology. He has a special research interest in applied neuroscience and has lectured in chiropractic neurology, diagnosis, and preclinical studies at Macquarie University for over the last 12 years. Brent was also on the faculty of teaching staff at the Carrick Institute of Graduate Studies as an assistant professor and was responsible for teaching over 150 hours in 6 3-day modules to Australian students of the American program in neurorehabilitation. He has published numerous papers in peer-reviewed journals and has received many awards, including radiology, academic excellence, human cadaver dissection, and even has the title of preceptor. He has treated various Australian cricket players, Australian ballet performers, American baseballers, Olympic-level athletes and triathletes, Ironman women, tennis players, and marathon runners. Brent traveled extensively with Anna Ivanovich, if my pronunciation is correct, former world number one Serbian tennis player, for 5 years, and was involved with major events such as the Australian Open, Beijing Olympics, the US Open, the French Open. Dr. Brent Gordon, welcome, and thank you for joining us on the ACA podcast today.
Thank you. I didn't expect you to read that whole blurb. It hasn't been changed for a while, so
that's quite neat. If you've got more things to add on, that's pretty extensive. That's amazing. And it's fantastic for our profession, I think, to have people such as yourself who are highly dedicated in a specific field. I think it's wonderful that we should herald people like yourselves and then, you know, bring you into the public foray about discussions that you specialize in. So thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. Appreciate your time.
No problem.
Today we're going to discuss a particular paper. Well, somewhat of a discussion of the paper, but I mean, the paper sort of highlights something
it's a starting point, right?
Yeah, it's a starting point. And I think it's a great discussion to have because it's something that our profession has wrestled with, I guess, for quite some time. And I'm sure that the general public has an understanding, but probably the wrong perception, maybe not quite an understanding, but the wrong perception of how we fit into what we're going to dive into. The topic obviously is carotid cerebral artery dissection. Obviously, there is a big issue and concern by the general public about how chiropractic is perceived. And also, I'm going to say, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Brent, about some professionals also having the perception that we as chiropractors are deemed dangerous or I'm going to say more likely to create an artery dissection. Would that be the case?
Yeah, look, I mean, I had a situation this week. I had a lady who just come to see me, and she had seen me before. And so like maybe a year ago, and then she's been suffering this shoulder problem and has been seeing various people and said to her GP a few months ago, and she's been having more scans and tests, and she said, you know, should I get this treated? I'd like to go back to my chiropractor. I've seen my chiropractor before. He's helped me before. And the doctor was like, oh, no, you definitely don't need a chiropractor, and you know, it can be quite dangerous. And so a few months on, she's really sore still. She comes in to see me quite sheepish and saying, oh, I'm not sure I should be seeing you. And my doctor told me I shouldn't see you. And then, you know, I was able to quite, you know, help her significantly just yesterday. And and she's like, oh, I knew I should have come back to see you. And then she was wondering why the doctor doesn't want, you know, me to see her. And I said, look, there is a history where a lot of doctors are quite unsure and are concerned, and it's almost like a medical dogma that basically chiropractic equals stroke. And I know when you told me or asked me, would I like to come onto this podcast, I thought, what could we talk about? And there's so many things you could talk about. And I thought, you know, I'd like to approach the elephant in the room, because it is the sort of thing that you sort of, as a chiropractor, people say, oh, wow, that's amazing, I love chiropractors, or, oh, my God, like, I can't believe people you know, everyone's going to die, like, when we be seen by a chiropractor. And I think I'd like people to understand that, you know, the risks of going to a chiropractor and having a stroke are equivalent to the risk of going off and seeing the GP and having a stroke, okay? So there's long been thought that people sort of said, oh, you know, chiropractors cause a stroke, but at the end of the day, there's an association with stroke and visiting a chiropractor's office, but that same association exists with visiting any primary care physician and off to to having a stroke. So the question is, you know, is there a causation, or is it, you know, just an association? And it's quite clear from this study, and it was quite lovely to sort of see this study done, because the good news about this study was it wasn't set up by a bunch of chiropractors. This was done, at the Department of Neurosurgery at, you know, Penn State. It's a Hershey Medical Center, which is a huge hospital. It's got, I think, 600 odd beds, and it's an academic center as well as a teaching facility and hospital. And a lot of people work there, and these neurosurgeons and neurologists got together and sort of thought, you know, let's have a look at this. Are they really being caused by chiropractors? So, it was nice to come across this study. I remember at the time when it came out, I was like, this is great. I don't know that it received as much traction as it should have received, but I think it's been, you know, really good to have this in. I've been to a bunch of neurologists, and they've gone, oh, wow, I had no idea that was the case.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is good to be able to have that up our sleeve, so to speak. And I really appreciate you sharing the study. For all the listeners, what we will do is we'll include the actual study that Brent's referring to. It's a systematic review and meta-analysis of chiropractic care and cervical artery dissection. And so we'll include that paper in the actual podcast to make sure that everybody gets a copy of it, so they can have it as a resource, really. I thought it was a really good paper, Brent. Firstly, in terms of the actual correlation between, I guess it's mainly for more public perception, but is it really, the study itself showed that it was very low risk, and we'll go into that in a bit more detail in a second, but how do we break down that perception by the general public that we are the primary instigators or causes of stroke in people with what we do? Because really the paper outlines very clearly that it's exceptionally low risk.
Yes. Yeah. And to be honest, I think in some ways, if you look at the actual risk numbers, it's something along the lines of, what do they say here? First of all, you need to understand the difference between stroke and all the different types of strokes. I think this is really important for people to understand, is that, you know, you've got a ischemic stroke, okay, where a blood vessel gets blocked off and the right amount of blood doesn't get delivered to the part of the brain. You've got hemorrhagic stroke, which is a vessel that actually bursts and bleeds and causes damage to the brain. And you've also got subarachnoid hemorrhage. So the ones that we're really talking about are the cervical artery dissection, which fall under the ischemic stroke category. And so they are a relatively small proportion of the number of strokes that people have that arise from the cervical vessels. So they're either going to come from the internal carotid system or the vertebral system. So your brain's got four main blood vessels that supply the brain. You've got two internal carotids, two vertebral arteries. And both the internal carotids or the vertebral arteries can actually be damaged. And it's thought that the internal carotid system happens slightly more than the vertebral artery system. Mm. And so I think a lot of people, they think, well, the vertebral arteries go up through the neck bone, so maybe when chiropractors twist and turn them, that's probably, you know, causing it. But there's a relative incidence of this just in the general population that doesn't even see a chiropractor. So, you know, you've got four per 100,000. So up to, four, and it depends on the system. Some people say it's up to one in 20,000. So, but essentially those sorts of numbers are there. And that relative incidence compared to the number of people that see a chiropractor, actually, I think, you know, it's quite low. And I mean, I know there was Haldeman did his, you know, study, and he came up with that 1 in 5.85 million.
I remember,
the figure that everyone likes, you know, that
yeah,
you know, I looked at how he based that figure and how he come to that figure, and because if you got 1 in 20,000, like just in the general population, you know, 1 in 5.85 million is like, it's fantastic, like, you know,
yeah,
in that group than in the general population just walking around,
yeah.
So, I mean, he based that off across 10 years, a bit over 10 years, there were 23 cases of vertebral artery dissections. And then in that 10-year period in Canada, as a Canadian study, he calculated that there were over 134 million chiropractic adjustments to people's necks. And so when he sort of divided that figure by the 23 cases, he came up with the fact that, you know,
it's one in every five million,
right? So neck adjustments. And, you know, it was interesting. He had made the comment back then, this was back in 2001. And so you've got to remember now, this study now that we're talking about is 2016. But those 23 cases, that of those 23 cases, those patients had seen a total of 216 physicians over the time that they were getting diagnosed and what was going on. And 69 of those were neurologists as well. So these people had seen a lot of different people.
Yeah.
I guess then the question is, the cervical vessels, you know, can they be damaged in any sorts of movement patterns? And the trouble is there's reports of people having these strokes after very minimal events, like, you know, playing volleyball, brushing your teeth, going to the hairdressers,
yeah.
You know, putting your head back in a position. And, you know, obviously if there's a vulnerability in a vessel, that vulnerability can play itself out. And so, you know, I think some of these neurologists and neurosurgeons in America sort of realize that, hang on, not everyone who comes in with this has seen a chiropractor. So a chiropractor is not the cause of cervical artery dissection. And I, you know, it comes down, and this is what I often explain to neurologists and doctors and good friends of mine, is that, you know, these people will walk into our office. They will walk into your office. Our job is to identify when someone walks into the office that has some symptoms, because quite often most of these people have had for days and weeks leading up to it, they've had some symptoms suggesting that their artery is dissecting. Mm-hmm. And so if you describe what a dissection is, I mean, it's the internal lining of the vessel splitting, and then blood and thrombus can form underneath that split, and then it can flap over and close off that vessel, or it can throw off an emboli which goes off into the brain because of that vessel that's been damaged. So I guess the doctors, you know, looking at that and seeing that these people, well, what are they going to present with to the chiropractic office? And you know, so the biggest thing is they present with is neck pain and headache. And, and I'll have some things. So the biggest red flags, if someone comes in, I guess, with, and I'm not sure if I'm going off piste here, but like, and whether you want me just to chat about what they'll come in.
Exactly. No, that's perfect. Keep going.
I think, you know, these people will come in, they've got, you know, they've got neck pain. It can be severe and or sudden head pain. If they've got pain behind one eye, okay, that's often an association, because you've got to realize the sympathetic blood, sympathetic nerves travel up into the brain from the thoracic level of the cord. They hitch a ride on the internal carotid artery, on the outside of the internal carotid artery. So they're then supplying the sympathetics for the eye. And so, which is also can describe why if someone comes in and they've got a painful eye and the eyelids dropped a little bit, they have some ptosis. You have to be extremely suspicious that there's something else going on. This is not just a facet joint irritation of their neck. So if they've got neck pain and they've got head pain, if it's obviously if they've got any stroke-like symptoms, okay, so if they've got any nausea, dizziness, loss of sense of speech, any weakness, numbness, and all those other things, that's obviously they're very big red flags. They can just have scalp pain. Or a feeling of like pulsation in their ear or any sort of vascular type sort of thing that might show up there. So if you've got any of those things, this is your at-risk patient. This is the patient who's potentially walking into your office with a dissecting artery. And so, you know, when you examine your patient, you would take your history. Obviously, the history is, you know, so important. You know, you want to basically identify that patient to say this is a potentially at-risk patient for this condition. If anything seems other than normal for a mechanical neck problem, that's the patient that needs to be investigated to have a look at and see if there's anything else going on that can be causing that. Because you don't want to be, you know, left with the smoking gun, right?
Exactly.
You know, so.
Exactly. It's interesting. Yeah, I remember I did a podcast with Dr. John Kelly, and he obviously has represented a lot of cases whereby somebody's been injured. And one of the things that he often said was the history is really important, because often you'll get a patient walk into your office and it wasn't the fact that you had actually done anything, but they were a ticking bomb. They were it just so happened to be that you didn't take a good history. And then as a result of what you did, that's easy to lay blame, right? Like you're saying, holding the smoking gun at the end of it all, right?
And you certainly, you know, you can't cut corners, right? When someone's coming in and you're like, oh, you know, it just sounds like a neck problem. Oh, a bit of a headache, you know. But you really want to have a good understanding, you know, do they typically get headaches? Is this their same normal headache that they get? Is this, you know, or is this different? And how is it different? And, you know, how have they been feeling in the lead up to this? And, you know, do they have some of the risk factors for stroke and things? Although I will say cervical artery dissections are often they can be a younger group, you know. They can be a group that, you know, they're not necessarily overweight. They're not necessarily old. They don't necessarily smoke. Although, you know, nowadays you have to be very careful too. You know, there's so many factors that can affect vessels and things. So, you know, oral contraceptive pill, you know, in a young woman with that who smokes, their risk factors for vascular injuries are, you know, skyrocketing. It's like since COVID, I mean, COVID virus itself, and if you've had experienced COVID, you know, in the previous little while, there's basically a direct correlation, obviously, with people who have COVID and an increased risk of stroke. That's, you know, there's some papers on that right now. You're much more likely to have a stroke if you've had COVID infection in the previous few weeks. We obviously know that there was a risk factor for stroke from, you know, AstraZeneca vaccine, and there were people who had that, and that was sort of a problem. But there's been papers now showing that there's, you know, increased risk for non-hemorrhagic stroke, which is what we're talking about, sort of ischemic type stroke, even after the, you know, the safer Pfizer sort of vaccine as well. And so there's, you know, lots of papers on that. And even risk of TIA in the periods of, you know, few weeks after having that. So I think, you know, we have to consider that. So if you have a patient that's just had some of these things, you know, you've got to be on higher alert.
Absolutely, which also highlights that particular in that paper in figure three. There was a thing towards the end there where it showed the figure three where it talked about the nature of potential co-founding factors.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I can only imagine, based on even just what you said there, the effect of the vaccines, the COVID, and I'm assuming also things such as the increased nature of having a lot of head trauma at the moment. So, for example, sporting head traumas, right? So concussion. So all these factors, I'm assuming, would be a large co-founding probability of the likelihood of, you know, walking into your office and then as a result having those cervical artery issues.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back and remember, you know, the issue with the Australian cricketer, Philip Hughes.
Exactly.
He unfortunately copped a ball in the wrong place at the wrong time with his head turned in the wrong direction. So he exposed his vertebral artery by turning his head away from the ball, lengthened the artery, stretched the artery, and then he got hit directly over the artery, which just split the entire artery. And so, you know, that's a case of, you know, significant trauma, you know, in a position that's like that. So, you know, really just super unfortunate.
Yeah, I remember that day, obviously being a cricketer, and you've looked after a lot of cricketers as well. It was tragic. And I mean, the likelihood of that though, Brent, I mean, the likelihood.
But interesting, I looked that up actually afterwards and it's like, what are the chances? And then it turns out there's been a bunch of them around the world, like through India and Sri Lanka and countries that play a lot of cricket.
Yeah.
So he wasn't the first.
Is that right?
But he's obviously, but he's probably the first playing at that level. Well, obviously first playing at that level. But it was a lot reported in lower levels of, you know, Indian
interesting.
Cricket.
Interesting. Yeah, so, interesting.
But it certainly changed the helmet design now, and there's now that extra device there to sort of protect the vertebral artery. But it's interesting. I mean, we're both cricketers.
Exactly. So love it.
You know, cricket, back in the day, you didn't wear a helmet, right?
Exactly.
We didn't wear a helmet. Right at the end of my career, I started wearing a helmet, and I didn't love them. But my grandfather had taught me that you never take your eye off the ball.
Yeah.
And when you've got no helmet, like, you don't want to take your eye off the ball. But when you do have a helmet, you get this false sense of security. And it's the same thing with concussion in the NFL. You know, they go in with this helmet on, like, great, I can just lead with my head. Yeah. And that causes more brain injury, even though they've got a helmet on because of the shaking brain. But when you don't have a helmet on, you're playing cricket, you keep your eye on the ball and you duck or you weave to get away from it. But when you've got a helmet on, they're quite happy to get hit in the head because they're like, well, it's all right, I'm getting protected. And so they'll often just duck into it or, you know, turn it away, take it on the back of the helmet.
And so
it's not been good. So teaching young kids, you still should teach them to, you know,
keep your eye on the ball.
And no matter what happens.
Yeah, I remember distinctly as a kid going through the exact same thing. Never take your eye off that ball, you know. Always stand right behind that ball. To be honest, it's probably a good thing for the sport itself, that the fact that they have those protective mechanisms now for the kids. I remember we grew up in an era where it was very much quite the swashbuckling type of a scenario, right? And the swagger into the middle of the pitch with no helmet meant that you're ready for it, you know, which is kind of silly when you think about it. But we grew up in that era, right? So anyhow, we're slowly diverging away from our conversation here, but
look, you know, the point is that the cervical arteries, you know, they can be exposed and they can get damaged to various things, and a lot of cases, you know, the people will present to hospital, they haven't seen a chiropractor, they haven't necessarily seen a doctor, they just present to hospital, and they won't even be able to tell you what's happened to cause that arterial wall dissection. But the arteries over time can become less and less healthy, and, you know, just like, you know, your hose in the yard that gets a bit sort of sun damaged and a bit of build up of plaque on the inside of the hose, and then the car drives over it a couple of times and the wall can split and do that. So, you know, people do need to be aware that this can happen to anyone.
What are some of the more common, I mean, you sort of just touched on the nature of how the artery over time naturally degenerates and degrades. What are some of the more common things for our listeners in terms of, as a practitioner, they should look out for, lifestyle factors that a patient who presents that we need to be mindful of, outside of, you know, direct trauma? Or you said earlier about, for example, young people and women who are on the pill and who smoke. What are some other lifestyle factors that contribute towards that we as practitioners need to be mindful of?
Well, I think lifestyle factors and genetic factors too. So the hyperflexible person, that hypermobile person that might have, you can start also considering, you know, do they have is there a Marfan syndrome, or is there some sort of other sort of You know, have they got stretchy skin? Have they got sort of, you know, all that sort of stuff? Because then the vessels in those situations might be more immediate, you know, problematic when it comes to some of those things as well. Lifestyle factors, obviously, you know, smoking is a big factor for blood vessel health. So, you know, and now...
Would you include the nature of vaping now?
Look, I think, you know, realistically, yes. I mean, look, vaping still delivers the drugs to our system. You know, there's still an irritant to the lung. Maybe it's not as bad insofar as that smoke irritant into the lungs as well. So it's all that, the extra stuff. But I don't know that anyone's done any studies on that yet as to how, because we haven't had them long enough to sort of realize the outcomes for these 14, 15, 16 year olds lining up at the TSG stations to get their
vapes.
Vapes. You know, look, but I'd be very surprised if there was, you know, health benefits from doing it. So, so I think, you know, you've really,
we can easily classify that. Yes. Go on.
You know, I think, you know, look, general, I mean, the biggest factor too, also blood pressure. I mean, if you can have a system that is fine, but as soon as that blood pressure shoots up, the pressure, that internal pressure on that vascular system pushing against those walls makes everything a whole lot more risky. So keeping an eye on people's blood pressure. Basically, I often tell my male patients that, you know, when blood pressure is going up, it's when their erections are going down. So basically, if you know, for that scenario, it's a good indicator that someone's blood pressure is shooting up. So their parasympathetics aren't working as well. Sympathetics are sort of starting to dominate and have, you know, more difficult maintaining an erection, and their vascular system is under a heightened sort of response to actually cause tension in those vessels to increase the blood pressure. So, yeah.
Interesting. Obviously, those are easy to identify, I guess, or ask the question of in the history of taking with the patients. But what are there any things that don't obviously then stand out, which we also still need to be mindful of? I'm just trying to think of...
I mean, hypertension, diabetes, hypercholesterol issues, positive family history. Don't fall far from trees. I think it's a lot of people forget to really hone in on someone's family history, you know, and parents, siblings. If they've got older siblings, I think it's great. Like you can say, you know, brothers and sisters, how's their health? You know, have they got this issue and that issue? And if they've got type 2 diabetes, if they've got, you know, hypertension, if they've got all those other things, like, you know, you can sort of say, well, if you've been doing similar things and had a similar diet through childhood, so that childhood diet's really important. So someone might be eating really healthy right now, so they fill out a form and it says, I'm eating really well, but like, what did I eat the 20 years, 30 years, 40 years before that, you know? And how's that? If you've got, you know, I mean, atrial fibrillation is such a big, important thing to talk about when it comes to stroke. I mean, that's probably one of the, you know, leading causes of, you know, ischemic stroke for people is actually some thrombus on the inside of their heart, inside of those valves. And then as soon as the heart starts becoming arrhythmic, you can shoot off emboli, you know, very easily. And if they just so happen to go up to through those vessels, the internal carotid or vertebral artery, you know, they'll head off into the vertebrobasilar system. And then, you know, people present, they're really presentation for them is like they get a homonymous hemianopia. So they lose vision on one side because those vessels supply the posterior brain. So they head off to the occipital lobe and they often land there. And they're often an undiagnosed congenital hole in the heart. So it's been an issue. And they can be a young, healthy person. I know that a GP that happened to a very, you know, relatively, should have been, you know, late 30s had one of these sort of strokes that basically, you know, but come from the heart. You know, but if she'd seen a chiropractor, someone might have jumped to the conclusion that it was caused by a chiropractor as well, right?
Chiropractic adjustment,
Or, you know, had visited the GP or the neurologist or whatever.
Exactly.
So you do have to work at some point, so.
Yeah. Brent, do we know much about the nature of SMT, the force required in SMT to truly create this situation, this scenario?
Yeah, so I know the American Heart Association were really trying very hard at one point to sort of find out, you know, did chiropractors really cause it, and what's there that? And but one of the, like, that whole, you know, you need to know there's a temporal relationship with the actual procedure and the actual, you know, to establish that that was actually a cause. But basically, when you're looking at the plausibility and or coherence, so there's been tests on human cadavers that have revealed that the vertebral artery strains during spinal manipulative therapy, but they do not place significant strain on the vertebral artery. So a review of data related to this topic sponsored by the American Heart Association concluded that current biomedical evidence is insufficient to establish a claim that spinal manipulation causes cervical artery dissection, including data from a canine model. So they did this on dogs, showing no significant changes in vertebral artery lesions before and after cervical manipulation. So they were trying to work out, you know, can you stress that artery to cause enough strain on it to do that? And the experimental evidence, you know, goes on to say that the animal, available animal models do not support the association. And while severe trauma most certainly causes dissection, like in the case of Philip Hughes, but it may be debated whether the situation in chiropractic care is analogous to, you know, to doing that. So there's nothing to sort of prove that cause. I mean, obviously, if it was very dangerous, I mean, you know, from university training and students learning how to manipulate, because, you know, when you manipulate someone's neck, it can be done with such low force and very minimal strain. And as you, you know, as your experience as well, when people often come in, they're quite scared, and then you do something and they go, oh, wow, was that it? Then that was really comfortable and nice. That didn't hurt at all. And it's like, no, it's not meant to hurt. I think if it does hurt, you know, you might be increasing your chances of causing someone injury. So, because a nice neck adjustment shouldn't hurt someone.
Yeah, exactly.
And it certainly, you know, shouldn't be doing that. So these vessels are made to turn, right? We can turn our head 90 degrees in a healthy individual, or 70 to 90 degrees, more in a child. And the vessels can stretch and they're quite comfortable doing that. So, and we're not turning someone's head 90 degrees to do an adjustment. So,
exactly.
You know, we take rotation out of the equation.
And so, that's certainly something that I do recall from university days, the nature of we're not likely to take it to the extremes of movement with the adjustment anyway. So, I think that, again, it comes back down to what we spoke about right at the start, is the nature of the public's perception of it. And also our colleagues, colleagues meaning, you know, the physiotherapists, the doctors and the like, they probably need to be educated on exactly the nature of a SMT and the unlikelihood of it being a causative factor.
Well, I treat a lot of doctors, and I treat a bunch of neurologists, and they send their children into me now because they trust me now, and they've told me that they would never have done that before. Like, you know, only now that I've sort of educated them in time and you know, they're quite comforted by the fact that, you know, we're actually apparently we're educated, right? We've done equivalent hours to them and study, and they're like, wow, okay, you actually do know some stuff. And so, you know, unfortunately, this, you know, situation we have, you know, it's become dogma that chiropractic equals stroke, right? Now I think this paper has shed some very good light on the fact that, you know, association doesn't equal causation. We're not likely doing it. You know, the risk profile is the same whether or not you see us or a neurologist or a GP or, you know, a massage therapist. But yeah, identifying those risks is key message, I think.
I think the I guess it comes back down to education based on a paper such as this, because the paper clearly shows in its conclusion how it talks about it rates it, quote unquote, very low. I think they had a grading scale from memory for the paper, and it showed that on that scale it is regarded as being very low. So for a paper such as that to come up with such a finding, this is significant.
Not by a bunch of chiropractors. Someone outside of our, who, you know, might have thought, some people might have thought they had a vested interest to prove the other way. And so, but it seems like this is, you know, it was a good study. And And look, do we need more studies? Of course, you know. But you know, it can be hard to get that. You know, you're not going to get a double blind control study on this. You know.
Yeah.
So you know, meta analysis is like the absolute best you can have right now. For that, and I think made another point is that there's no convincing evidence to support a causal link, but then they said that unfounded belief in causation may have dire consequences insofar as the litigation system is concerned. So people immediately assume that patient has seen chiropractor, presents to hospital, you know, diagnosed, has a stroke, has a vertebral artery dissection or carotid artery dissection, that caused it, offer goes to court. You know, look, in that system, sometimes it's easy just to sort of, you know, let it go and sort of don't defend, because it, you know, it can cost a lot of money to defend something, and just sort of pay out a figure, and then it's like, well, if you paid out a figure, you obviously caused it, you're admitting guilt, but what's going to save that whole situation, and this is what John Kelly would say as well, is that what brings most people down insofar as is poor note taking of if you haven't written it down, it didn't happen, right? You could have done the best history in the world and done the best examination in the world, but if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen.
100%.
And so as far as the legal system is concerned, you have to write all those things down that you did to protect yourself and to protect the patient, really. This is the most important thing here. It's not about protecting us. It's doing the right thing by that patient. And, you know, if that patient does walk into you and they have got a dissection, the best thing you can do for them is, you know, get them off to where they need to be. You know, manipulation in that situation is not going to make them better, and it's not going to make them, you know, better quicker, and it can slow down the process that they need to be investigated, or give them a false sense of security that it is just their neck causing their headache and eye pain and their ptosis that's developed, and they don't do the right thing. So
yeah.
And look, there's not one test though either. So people say, what do I do? Do I just send them for a Doppler ultrasound? Do I send them for an MRA, like a magnetic resonance angiogram? Send them for a CT angiogram? You know, realistically, all three of those are good potential options. You know, the ultrasound might miss the vertebral artery dissection, but it might pick up an internal carotid artery dissection. The CT angiography is really good at you know, delineating all these things, but you're not going to send everyone for a CT angiogram. the risks of doing the angiogram can be, you know, like just injecting dye into someone's not great as well. So, it's a hard one.
In terms of the screening techniques, so you sort of touched on that, and also obviously the scanning techniques are vital if you're suspecting that. But prior to that point, are there, for example, as we were going through university back in the day, we would always taught, make sure you do, you know, your vertebral artery test, you know, the mains test and what have you. So are they still relevant, and do they still show an obvious indication whereby if a person was deemed positive, and then that way the practitioner can deal with it accordingly?
Unfortunately, like the validity of that extension rotation test of the neck is actually not there. Like, you know, so if you did that test and went, nah, they passed, and then they could still have a dissecting, you know, artery, okay? So it doesn't mean they won't have one. Everyone's got a stethoscope, right? Stick the bell of the stethoscope over those arteries, you know, and have a listen. Is there a bruit? You know, can you hear turbulent blood flow in those blood vessels? That's a simple thing to do. And, so if you've got a patient that you're concerned and worried about, just stick a stethoscope on there, have a listen. That's probably better than actually doing the extension rotation test. I think another factor is that if you've got a patient and they're in, you know, the provocation, like just before you do, you know, are you okay in that position? Does that feel okay? You know, like don't go quickly doing anything without sort of just making sure the patient's okay in that position. That's probably better than actually, you know, the cervical extension rotation tests and things. So you know, it's questionable insofar as how useful that is. So, you know, that's, It's a hard one.
I think that just over time, obviously the nature of studies and research coming out that show other ways to try and validate the likelihood of minimizing, you know, a person, you know, having one of those in your office. Yes, back in the day, we only had the, you know, extension rotation type maneuver. But what you're saying there is there are other ways to try and pick up little subtle cues.
You know, look, they're coming in, they've got vertigo, and you put them in that test, that'll provoke their symptoms because they've got crystals in their ear, most likely, you know, benign positional vertigo. It doesn't mean they've got a dissected aneurysm, right?
True.
So you can sort of go, oh, there you go, there's a positive test. So, but the treatment for that's very different. You're going to do an Epley maneuver and Dick's Hallpike test and other things. So,
exactly.
Yeah. So it is looking at that big picture, taking a very good thorough history.
Yeah.
As you know, you feel much more comfortable when the patient's got a headache that it's similar to headaches they've had in the past. It's nothing different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing. If someone comes in and they've got a bit of a, you know, that thunderclap headache, you know, you're now going to be thinking that other type of stroke, a subarachnoid hemorrhage. You know, something is going off in that system. So anything that's unusual and the patient hasn't experienced before, or that unilateral pain behind the eye, you know, severe pain, and, you know, neck pain that's unrelated to anything, like, you know, and if you're doing someone, you're doing a test and you're sort of, you're putting them in a Kemp's position and there's no facet joint irritation and no localized pain over where it's sore, you know, it's just sore unrelated to movement provocation, you know, I'd be much more suspicious of a, you know, referred pain from an artery wall to the neck rather than the neck itself. I always feel much better when the patient's got pain in one or two directions, as you know, as opposed to all the directions of movement as well. So if you've got just pain on extension and rotation, but there's no pain on flexion and other things, it's sort of like, okay, well, this is much more mechanical based, you know, as opposed to if they've got pain, no matter what, you know, they're sitting there in pain and it hurts to move any direction at all, and they've got, you know, head pain and eye pain and other things, and you can't even get into a position to even test them. You probably might do some, you know, bit more evaluation before you start just, you know, doing things.
Rusting into it. Absolutely. Tell me, I don't know if whether or not there's a correlation, nor is there any, are there any papers out there, but certainly I mentioned it earlier with the nature of concussion. I know that it's such a big discussion. A few podcasts back, I spoke to combat sports chiropractor Alex Alvarez, and we were discussing the nature of concussion in sport in general. But I wonder whether or not concussion is one of those co-founders that are now, because there's a lot more and a lot more people playing sports and a lot more awareness of the nature of concussion, whether or not some of that would be a, the concussion itself would be a serious cofactor to a, you know, a vertebral artery dissection walking into your office.
Yeah, look, if someone's had, you know, significant head trauma, you know, like you don't get, whiplash and concussion go together, right? So, and certainly a high-speed motor vehicle accident can cause an artery dissection, you know, apart from lots of other issues. So, you know, when someone's been running very hard at someone else and they're hitting, clashing heads or hitting someone's knee and things, I mean, it definitely sort of something to consider.
Do we know if whether or not there is any correlation between the two at the moment? Have there been many studies done at the moment regarding concussion and
dissections or just concussion?
Yeah, dissection or no, the dissections in particular.
Look, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly case reports of you know, instances where it's happened, but not, there's no big study that I know of that sort of says you get this percentage of dissections in concussion type injuries as well. But you know, treatment wise, we know, you know, the treatment strategies we use around concussion and whiplash tend to be quite similar now, and using a lot of visual targeting and vestibular type treatments and getting really good results with those people. That's kind of nice. So, you know,
That'll be all that functional neurology that you've, you're specializing in. You probably see quite a few of those, I suspect.
We do. And it's interesting, like the people's after a concussion, you know, because you can't not damage the neck flexors and things as well. So they'll have poor control of their deep neck flexors. And so you really want to improve their deep neck flexor control. And you can do that with, you know, laser pointers and holding their head still, and they track, you know, different sort of shapes and objects and things. And if you do it with someone who's not had an injury, they're quite good. Someone who's had an injury, they're terrible. Like they're tracking mechanism through their neck.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really poor. But it's you've got to retrain it and
absolutely
and get those connections back again. Show them that it's poor so that then they can then see that, you know, laser point is good. They don't lie. They tell you exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
That's
fantastic. Yeah. Well, certainly it's a growing field within our profession. So I think it's a great thing. It just puts us on the map amongst other practitioners to know that we are more than just what the public perceives us to be, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we on the podcast like to do, Brent, and I'm going to throw you here, is that the ACA have always worked tirelessly to support its members and also in particular student and new grads, because we know that obviously they are the future of our profession, you know, down the track. With your level of experience and your expertise and the wonderful knowledge that you've gained over the years, I'm going to ask you to leave three tips for these new students and young graduates, because I know they often listen to the podcast and I want to be able to get them to feel safe, I guess, if not anything else, but certainly three tips that you can give.
First tip is surround yourself with good mentors. Like, so definitely follow some people that you like and look out for them. When you're listening, I think a big one is listening to patients. So quite often the students are so caught up in like, oh, I've got to do this, and this, and I'm going to ask these questions and ticking boxes, right? And they actually don't really listen to the person. And the patient actually often sees that they're not listening and so it's very easy for the patient to sort of not get a good sort of sense of this practitioner's really sort of keeping an eye on what's going on.
Yeah.
So definitely listen to the patient. And I think the other one is if a mother ever comes in and says there's something wrong with my child, there generally is.
Yeah.
I think you've got to trust that parental instinct.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say mother, but it is mother and father, but mothers tend to often know a bit more about the kids than the dads sometimes. And so I always, if someone's come in and they've seen other people and doctors, but they just know there's still something wrong with their kid, it turns out, gee, there really was something wrong with them.
Far out. It's so funny. I cannot agree with you more. That is just one of my golden rules. And it was, I don't know where you heard that, but I certainly recall distinctly Dr. Neil Davies saying that because I went and did the seminars that he presented back in the day. And that's the one thing that stood out for me, and all the stuff he taught me was the nature of no matter how far or where they have taken this child, and everybody says that this child is fine and the mother does not believe it, you hang on tight and you do every test under the sun because something will come up. And that has.
Although I had the opposite the other day. Neil Davies is good. I had the opposite though. The other day, I had a young girl. She's 15, and the mum sort of begrudgingly did bring her in because she'd hurt her knee skiing and things, and she's been hobbling around, and the mum's like, "Oh, you know, she's quite a drama queen. She's this, she's that." And I said, "Oh, let me just check." And she'd blown her lateral collateral ligament and partial rupture of her ACL. And the mum felt so bad because she didn't believe it for like a week after this ski trip. And,
oh gosh!
And she's like, "Oh my god, I'm such a bad." And she goes, "It's because she always complains." And this time she really did have significant injury. So
there's always an exception to the rule.
There is. But definitely listen to those.
I think that they're really, really valid points. I certainly know that often the students and the new grads do ask, you know, what should I look out for? What are the things I need to be mindful of? How should I? Yeah, and there's a lot of asking, like you're saying, and there's not a lot of listening. So I think that's a significant point that a lot of young people
can. When you're doing your tests, right? So don't just run through every single test under the sun, you know, like you want to, you're trying to prove or disprove. You're after your history, you've sort of, you should have a list of differential diagnoses, and now you've set up your hypothesis, and now you're trying to work out or prove or disprove each of those differential diagnoses. So you do tests around those to say, yeah, it is that, or no, it's not that. It could be this and it could be that. So most of the time when you go into your exam, you should have a reasonable idea where it's going to go. Occasionally it can change based on your exam findings, but really a lot of people rush to history just to get their hands on the patient. and then they don't know where they're going, and they just do all the same tests on everyone, and most of which are irrelevant. And
exactly.
but they've ticked all the boxes.
Yeah.
they won't get Brent, they won't so get the funny. Diagnosis and the conclusion. So,
well, hopefully we can help them to shortcut some of the lessons they're going to learn over the years and on their journey anyhow. But it's been fabulous. It's always lovely to catch up with you, mate. And really appreciate your time as always. Thank you so much for your knowledge and sharing your wisdom with not only just me, but also our listeners. So I appreciate that enormously.
Oh, thank you. And you're doing a great job for the association. So keep it up.
Oh, thanks, mate. I appreciate that. Okay. Well, that's it for me. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope this podcast has been helpful in your quest for excellence. And I look forward to chatting with you again on our next ACA podcast.